Leah was asleep. David showed up at the statue construction site a few minutes after 5 in the morning, Carpathia time. Guy started in with something sarcastic about how now they could finish their work. David held up both hands.
Sorry if I held you up.
Minister Blood, a word, please. Guy seemed so shocked that David had addressed him with proper protocol in front of his staff that he dropped what he was doing and joined him several feet away. David thrust out his hand, and Guy, clearly suspicious, shook it tentatively.
I want to apologize for speaking inappropriately to you, sir. I trust you'll find me helpful and not a hindrance to your work from here on.
What?
I said I want to apologize.
I heard you, Hayseed. I'm waiting for the punchline.
That's all I had to say, sir.
I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop, Guy said in a sing-song tone.
That's all, sir. Will you forgive me?
I'm sorry?
I said, that's all, sir.
I heard you. I'm trying to digest this. The Supreme Commander put you up to this, didn't he?
Well, I didn't squeal on you.
Come on, who made you do this?
David would have loved to have said God and blown Guy's mind.
No outside influence, Minister Blood. No ulterior motives. Just want to start over on the right foot.
Well, count me in, mister.
Is that an acceptance of my apology?
It's whatever you want it to be, soldier.
Thanks. No sense holding up the work any longer.
I should say not. We're ready to roll in 5.
Chapter 15. Buck struggled to open his eyes. He had never felt so beat up. The dawn sun peeked through the blinds in a small infirmary. He wasn't sure where. He had awakened to the quiet praying of 3 men who sat holding hands. One he recognized as Lucas Miklos. The others were a tall, dark-haired man about his own age and an older, smaller Middle Easterner.
"How are you feeling, my friend?" Lucas said, approaching.
"I've been better, Laszlos, but you're a sight. Where are we, and how is Chaim?"
Lucas stepped closer and whispered,
"Chaim will be all right, but we had to come up with an alias for him. His nose was severely damaged and his jaw broken, so he has not spoken, and medical personnel are not suspicious, only curious. He's being operated on right now. Our document forger pulled off the impossible, so..."
"And our pilot is gone, right? I wasn't hallucinating."
"That is correct. Praise God he was a believer. His papers identified him as Tyrola Mark Delante. Was this an alias, or..."
"Didn't need an alias. He ran a small airport near us and was able to evade suspicious eyes."
Laszlos nodded.
"The GC will not allow bodies to be transported internationally. Let our church handle the burial."
Buck rolled his shoulders and rotated his head. Pain shot through his neck.
"What's your guy going to do about Chaim's picture?"
Lucas looked over his shoulder.
"Look what we planted after surgery."
He showed Buck an ID with the photograph nearly scraped off, a bit of white hair peeking through the top.
"Doesn't that look like it went through the crash?
We tried to persuade officials to postpone surgery until the swelling reduced, but they're short-staffed here, like everywhere.
Meanwhile, he's Tobias Rogoff, a retired librarian from Gaza, on his way to North America on a charter flight, the same one you're on."
"Does he know this?"
"We told him a few hours ago. Our story is that the charter insurance company has contracted with Albi Air to guarantee the completion of the trip as soon as you two are airworthy."
"I'm airworthy now,"
Buck said, looking over Laszlo's shoulder toward the little Middle Easterner. You must be Albie.
I am, sir,
he said with a thick accent and a slight bow. Your father-in-law and your friend Mr. McCullum and I go way back. Also, Abdullah Smith.
How well I know. I didn't expect to see your mark.
Is my father-in-law aware?
Albie shook his head.
This was very recent, within the week. I tried to contact Rayford, but I found him impossible to connect with. Of course, now I know why.
And how did you come to faith, sir?
Nothing dramatic, I'm afraid. I have always been religious, but Rayford and Mac and Abdullah all urged me to at least consider the writings of Dr. Ben-Judah. Finally, I did. You know what reached me? His assessment of the difference between religion and Christianity.
I know it well, Buck said, if you're referring to his contention that religion is man's attempt to reach God, while Jesus is God's attempt to reach man.
The very argument, Albie said. I spent a couple of days surfing the archives of Dr. Ben-Judah's website, saw all his explanations of the prophesied plagues and judgments, then studied the prophecies about the coming Christ. How anyone with a functioning mind could read that and not...
Forgive me, Albie, Laszlo said, but we must keep moving. We should tell you, Buck, that Dr. Rosenzweig's eyes danced at the prospect of a new identity. We don't know how long it will be before he can speak, but it's clear he can't wait to play-act as someone else.
Buck slid off the side of the bed.
Are we near the airport?
Laszlo shook his head.
We're north of Kozani. Albie has flown the new craft to Ptolemais, and when you and, Tobias are healthy, you'll leave from there. Meanwhile, as soon as we can get you out of here, you'll stay with us at the same safe house where we harbored Rayford.
We haven't met, Buck said, reaching past Laszlo's hand to shake hands with the tall, willowy one.
I'm sorry, Laszlo said. Pastor Demeter.
The pastor said,
Mr. Williams, I answered your phone a while ago and talked to your wife. She and your father-in-law are checking out a new safe house, and she was very relieved to hear that you and Chaim are alive. Naturally, they are distraught over Mr. Delante, particularly Rayford. Mrs. Williams wants to talk with you as soon as you are able.
I want to get home soon, Buck said. Albie, I'll bet you weren't planning on flying that far, were you?
I have nothing to return to Al-Basra for, Mr. Williams. Could you use another craft and another pilot?
Oh, I think the Trib Force might find room for the best black market contact in the world.
Demetrius handed Buck his phone. As Buck dialed, Laszlo explained that so far they hadn't seemed to arouse suspicion on the parts of the local GC.
They believe Demetrius works for me and that you are an American come to study the business.
Chloe didn't like the plan.
Get out of there, Buck, she told him. We found the perfect safe house. Even my curmudgeon father hopes so. Chaim is smart, but this clandestine stuff is not his game. Let us get you two healthy here.
You may be right, Chloe, he said. What time is it there? I've got to call my dad.
She paused.
Buck, it's after 8 in the evening and earlier out west, but that was one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you.
He read it in her voice.
Dad?
Yes.
And
your brother too, Buck. I'm so sorry.
How?
GC.
Looking for us?
That's what we understand.
But they didn't know where we are. That's why I never told them.
I know, sweetheart.
There may be some good news, too.
What?
Our source tells us that the first attempt to get information out of them had to be postponed. They were at church.
Chloe, don't.
It's true, Buck. Leah found a believer at Buffer who has access to these schemes, and she says that's from a reliable source.
Why wouldn't Dad have told me?
Maybe the timing wasn't right.
I wish I could know for sure.
Leah is trying to reach the church so they know what happened and can be on guard. She'll ask for the truth about your dad and brother.
Rayford had had to stop driving when news came of T's death. He walked a couple of blocks in the darkness, and when Chloe asked if she could walk with him, he thanked her but added, "I need a few minutes, hon."
Chicago was, naturally, a mess. Buildings in piles, rotting carcasses, vehicles crashed or burned. It seemed an appropriate ambiance for Rayford's sojourn. The hardest thing about living during this period, he decided, was the roller coaster of emotions. He could never get used to the shock of loss and the necessity to telescope mourning into minute slivers so it could be dealt with, and yet one could get on with the business at hand. In the past, with each death of someone close to him, Rayford had rehearsed the ever-growing list in his mind. He didn't do that anymore. He wondered if a person had a limit, some finite reservoir of grief that would eventually peter out and leave him with no tears, no regret, no melancholy. He stopped at what was once a corner and leaned over, hands on his knees. His grief supply was still stocked, and the pain of the loss gushed from him. Hard as it was, Rayford had to condense the bereavement caused by yet another aching amputation into a few brief hours. He was not allowed to dwell on it, to jot his memories, to console a widow, to break the news to a congregation. There would be no wake, no funeral, not even a memorial service at the rate they were going. T's church was likely to have one, of course, but there was no way Rayford dared attend. Who knew who might be watching, lying in wait? Not enough of his comrades in the tribulation force really knew T. There would be little reminiscing. He was gone. They would see him in heaven. Now what was next on the crisis docket? It was unfair, unnatural. How was a person supposed to function this way and stay sane? Rayford was grateful for his own return to what Dr. Benjuda liked to call the first love of Christ, that wonderful season when the plan of salvation and the truth of grace are fresh and new. He was thankful for the counsel of Demetrius Demeter and the refreshing rest and new sense of resolve he enjoyed. And now this. The thrill ride. He'd had enough ups for 24 hours, apparently. He had been due for some downs. As usual, when in a stretch like this, Rayford tried cataloging what he still had to be thankful for. Without fail, every blessing in his life had a name attached. Chloe, Kenny, Buck, Zion, Leah, her new friend he hadn't yet met, the two Zeeks, Chaim, David and Annie, Mac, Abdullah, Laszlos and his wife, Demetrius, Albie. Rayford wondered why Albie had been so eager to help in Greece and what it was he was so eager to tell him, but only in person. Rayford had to fight the knowledge that while his list might expand, it also had to suffer attrition. He had already lost so many, including two wives. He wouldn't allow himself to think about losing more relatives. When he returned to the rover, Leah reported that she had reached the leader of the house church Buck's father and brother had attended. "I told him I'd love it if he could talk directly to Buck, and he said he'd be happy to, but I didn't feel right about giving out Buck's number."
"That was wise," Rayford said. "Let Buck decide that. His phone is secure, but this pastor's is likely bugged if they just had a GC cleansing. Try Buck and give him the pastor's number.
Let him work out the contact. A few minutes later, Rayford parked near Strong's, and they cased the place, only to find it secure. The three of them sat on the sidewalk with their backs to the cold brick, and Rayford pulled out his phone. Something about the New Babylon pre-dawn David never liked. Maybe Israel was lusher. Both were desert areas, but the hour before daybreak in Israel had always invigorated him, made him look forward to the promise of the day. The dry, windless heat of New Babylon mornings, beautiful as the sunrises could be, David found suffocating. Watching Guy Blod put the finishing touches on the huge image of Nikolai Carpathia did little to cheer David. Not 100 feet away, hundreds of thousands of grieving pilgrims from all over the world moved in slow silence, waiting hours for their few seconds before the sarcophagus. It was sad enough that these blind, lost, misled minions clearly worried about their future due to the loss of their beloved leader. But here, behind great curtains, Guy and his assistants rhapsodized over the finished product. "Care to look close?" Guy asked David as he glided down on a motorized scaffold. Not really, David wanted to say, but how would he explain passing on such a so-called privilege? He shrugged, which Guy interpreted as affirmative, and the sculptor sang out instructions. "There's only room for one on the scaffold, and you have to run the controls yourself. Be careful." The first time I did it, I nearly knocked over one of my own creations." Guy showed David the controls, which consisted primarily of a joystick and speed selector. He was tempted to point the thing at the statue's head, shoot up, and knock it over. As David tentatively and jerkily practiced maneuvering the scaffold before rising, Guy hollered his cautions. "Careful of the smoke! The fire is lit under the knees, and the face has the only exhaust." "Why didn't you wait until it was in place to start the fire?" "We don't want to distract the crowds. This sort of art is a duet between sculptor and viewer, and my goal is that they participate in the illusion that the statue is alive." 24 feet high and made of metal? "Trust me, this works. People will love it. But it would spoil everything if they saw us dumping in the stuff for the fire." "What are you using for fuel?" David asked. "A form of shale," Guy said. "For kindling, onion skin paper." "Where'd that come from?" "Every tribe and nation," Guy said, and his people laughed. "Seriously, we have an unlimited supply of holy books from all over the world, the last contribution of the late Pontifex Maximus. He shipped from Rome all the holy texts that had been confiscated and donated from the various religions and sects when the One World Faith was established." David was repulsed, now certain he didn't want the closer look, but he was stuck. "Note the handiwork on the way up," Guy said. What was there to see but polished black iron? "You can touch, but be careful. It's delicately balanced." Nearly 2.5 stories up, David could hardly hear Guy anymore. Smoke wafted out the eyes, nostrils, and mouth of the quadruple-size image of Carpathia. It was uncanny. Though from that close the illusion was lost that the eyes were real, the features, having been made from the actual cast of the body, were perfect replicas. David was high enough to see past the statue to the horizon where the sun's pinks were just beginning to wash the sky. Suddenly he flinched and backpedaled, hitting the safety bar just above his waist. The whole scaffold shuddered, and he feared it might topple. "Hey!" one of Guy's assistants hollered. "What's going on up there?" Guy yelled. "You all right?" David waved. He didn't want to admit what he'd heard, what had made him jump. He steadied himself and listened. A low rumble, echoing as if from the belly of the image. Muffled and sonorous, it was clearly Carpathia's timbre. What was it saying, and how had they gotten it to do that? A chip? A disc player? A tape? He felt the vibration again, heard the hum, cocked his head to listen.
"I shall shed the blood of saints and prophets."
David whipped the control so the scaffold lurched down about 5 feet and stopped, swaying again.
"How did you do that?" he called down. "Do what?" "Get a recording in there."
Silence.
"Well, how did you? Where's the hardware, and what does the phrase mean?"
Guy was still staring up at him, obviously holding out.
"Guy!"
"What?"
"What didn't you hear? Do I have to repeat everything?"
"What didn't I hear? I didn't hear anything but you, David. What the devil are you talking about?"
David began his slow descent.
"The thing talks. How did you do it? Tape loop? Disc? What? And won't the heat or smoke destroy it?"
Guy rolled his eyes at his people. He whispered,
"What, are you serious?"
"You know blamed well I'm serious, Guy."
"So we're back to first names, are we?
Can we not get hung up on that right now, Minister, Director, Potent, take your choice, Blod?
The thing speaks. I heard it twice, and I'm not crazy."
"If you're not crazy, you're mistaken."
"Don't tell me I didn't hear what I heard."
"Then you're hearing things, Director Hasid. This thing hasn't been out of my sight since the shell was delivered. This isn't a theme park. I don't want giant talking action figures, okay? Are we all right now? May I have them start moving my big boy into position?"
David nodded and stepped back to let a monstrous forklift move in behind the statue. His phone chirped, and as soon as he answered, he heard a tone indicating another call.
"This is Director Hasid. Hold, please."
But as he punched in the other call, heard,
"Dave,"
and recognized Fortunato's voice.
"This is Director Hasid. Hold, please," he said again, switching back to Fortunato.
"Sorry, Commander, I'm watching the moving of the statue, and..."
"I'm sure that'll succeed without you, David. I'd appreciate not being put on hold in the future."
David knew he should apologize again to keep up appearances, but he was dwelling on how important his getting up before 5 a.m. was to Fortunato last night and how incidental it was now.
"We've got a situation here," Leon continued. "I need you in the conference room on 18 as soon as possible."
"Anything I need to bring or be thinking about?"
"No, well, yes. Captain McCullum's schedule."
"Oh, he's..."
"Tell me when you get here, David. Quickly, please."
David switched to his other call.
"That busy that early, huh, kid?" Rayford said.
"Sorry, what's up?"
David walked backward as he talked, watching the statue emerge from the preparation room and become visible to the crowds. The murmuring grew louder as people nudged each other and pointed. The statue leaned back against the forks of the truck, and not until it came into the beams of the spotlights did it become apparent to all that it was, as Guy had so delicately put it, au naturel. Oohs and ahs rose from the crowd. Then they began applauding and soon cheering.
"What in the world is going on there?" Rayford said.
David told him.
"I think they've waited so long to see the body that they would worship trading cards if we pass them out."
Rayford told David what had happened in Greece.
"I'm so sorry, Captain Steele. I only talked to Mr. Delandy a few times by phone, but I know you two were close."
"This is a hard one, David. They don't get any easier. Sometimes I feel like an albatross. The people who get close to me are soon gone."
David told him he was on his way to a mysterious meeting, and they debriefed each other again on what had happened at the gala.
"No matter what they say, sir, it's clear the shooting was accidental and that the bullet totally missed Carpathia." That doesn't make me any less of a scapegoat, but...
Oh, Captain, wait a second.
I hear the crowd. What happened?
Oh, man, it almost toppled over. They set down the statue and it rocked forward. People were diving out of the way. The forklift guy moved up to sort of catch it on its way back so it wouldn't fall that way, and that just made it rock forward again. I don't know how it didn't go over. It's settled now and they're nudging it straight. Oh, man.
He told Rayford of the built-in furnace, but said nothing about what he had heard.
That jostling must have stoked the fire, because the smoke is really pouring out now. You know they're burning Bibles, among other holy books, in there?
No.
Sir, I'm heading inside now, and I never asked what you called about.
I'm at the new safe house, David.
Yeah? How is it?
It looks fabulous, but we have one problem. It must lock automatically in emergencies. We can't get in. Can you unlock it from there?
David was near the elevator.
I can't talk here, sir, so let me just say yes, I'll get to that as soon as this meeting is over. I wish I could say when that will be.
Zion took a call from Chloe, informing him it was likely they would be back very late.
Any evidence of GC nosing around?
None, he said.
But he didn't add that he had been 93 million miles from Mount Prospect for at least 2 minutes. She spoke briefly to Kenny, who kept wanting to pull the phone from his mouth, and
see Mama.
Finally, he said,
love you too, see you later, bye-bye.
Zion, I appreciate this more than you know, Chloe said.
He's easy, he said, and you know I love him.
She told Zion what to feed Kenny and to put him to bed at 9. Much as he had enjoyed the baby, that was good news. Kenny often slept through the night.
David hadn't given himself time to worry what the big meeting was about. He just hoped he wouldn't be in there alone with Fortunato. David was the last to arrive. A dozen directors and above were there, including television personnel, most yawning and rubbing their eyes.
Let's get started, people, Leon began. We have a crisis. No one is leaving New Babylon. Despite the decimated population in the last 3.5 years, hotels are jammed and people are even agreeing to double up, 2 whole families in each room. Others are sleeping in the streets under lean-tos. The airport is crowded with big jets. They bring in capacity loads for the viewing, but they're canceling most outbound flights for lack of interest. You know what's happening, don't you?
The viewing is not meeting their felt needs, a woman said.
David recognized her as Hilda Schnell, head of Global Community Cable News Network.
I'm glad it was you who answered, Hilda, Leon said. We need your help.
What can I do? I'm staying for the funeral, too.
We were not prepared for this size crowd, Leon said. This will be twice as large as the Jerusalem gala.
Hilda said,
I still don't understand how GCCNN can help. Even at the gala, we merely...
Bear with me, Leon said.
As you know, we already pushed back the funeral and burial to accommodate the crowds. We assumed that 1 million or so people would still be waiting to view the body by the time we were ready for the ceremony. With more than 3 million here already, another estimated 1 million on their way, and virtually no one leaving... We have to regroup. Where are the big screens we used in Jerusalem, and do we have more?
Someone from event programming said they were in storage in New Babylon and that there would be enough, supplemented by smaller monitors, to handle the larger crowd.
But, he added, that will require a lot of man-hours and, of course, a layout scheme. The way the courtyard is cordoned off now will certainly not handle a crowd that size, especially if the ones who have already passed by the bier stay for the funeral, and I can't imagine why they're still in the city if that is not their plan.
My point exactly, Leon said.
I already have engineers on the new schematic, and let me be clear. Laborers are starting to rearrange barricades, chairs, crowd control ropes, and so forth. All this work will go on with no interruption of the viewing process. If the line has to be moved, that should be able to be done in an orderly fashion without stopping the procession. My question for you, Ms. Schnell, is whether your equipment can feed that many monitors. Some people, naturally, will be hundreds of yards from the podium.
We don't worry about that, Commander, Ms. Schnell said. We concern ourselves with providing the best visual and audio coverage of the event for television and leave it to your event organizers to make it work for their purposes.
Leon stared at her, expressionless.
What I am suggesting, madam, is that you do worry about it. We have singers, dancers, speakers, and the like to make this ceremony appropriate, not only to the occasion and the size of the live crowd, but also to the stature of the one we honor.
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
Just tell us what you want, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for the privilege.
Now Fortunata was smiling.
That the big screens from Jerusalem are already here, Director Hasid, eliminates my need for one of your pilots to go get them. If we could make use of your entire hangar crew, cargo staff, pilots and all, in crowd control, I would appreciate it. Viv Ivins will be coordinating that, so let her know how many are available and who they are. The new times for the ceremony and burial are noon and 2 p.m. today, respectively. Some dignitaries' speeches may be shortened, but those times are firm and may be announced effective immediately. Ms. Schnell, I'm assuming this event supersedes all other programming so that the entire globe may participate, including those who reach the airport in time to watch on television, but too late to be here in person.
She nodded. David fidgeted, knowing Rayford, Chloe, and Leah were waiting to get into the strong building. He wasn't certain he could remotely unlock a door, but he'd rather have been studying that than sitting through a logistics meeting. Fortunato soon left the details in the hands of his engineers, and David hurried out. On the way to his office, he saw the laborers already at work refashioning the massive courtyard into a vista that would accommodate the expected flood of humanity. According to the snatches of news reports he caught on the monitors lining the hallways of the palace complex, Leon was right. People of every ethnic background were interviewed at the airport, in line, and on the streets. Nearly every person expressed a desire to attend the funeral, even if they had already passed by the body.
"This was the greatest man who ever lived," a Turkish man said through an interpreter. "The world will never see another like him. It is the worst tragedy we will ever face, and we can only hope that his successor will be able to carry on the ideals he put forth."
"Do you believe Nikolai Carpathia was divine in any sense?" the reporter said.
"In every sense," the man said. "I believe it's possible that he was the Messiah the Jews longed for all these centuries, and he was murdered in their own nation, just as the scriptures prophesied."
As David settled in behind his computer in the privacy of his office, he left on the TV monitor hanging from the ceiling in the corner. GCCNN had followed that interview with a live feed from Israel, where thousands were listening to enthusiastic preachers running forward, falling on their knees, and then shouting of their new allegiance to Jesus the Messiah. The Jerusalem correspondent had with her a religious expert who attempted to explain. In the vacuum created by the deaths of both the head of the One World Faith and the supreme potentate of the global community, whom many considered every bit as much a religious as a political figure, spiritually hungry people are rushing to fill the gap. Longing for leadership and bereft of the one man who seemed to fit the bill,
They now find attractive this fairly recent craze of ascribing to the historical figure of Jesus the Christ the qualifications of the Messiah Israel has awaited so long. This phenomenon existed in small pockets of conservative fundamentalist Christian sects, but was fueled shortly after the vanishings by Dr. Zion Ben Judah, an Israeli biblical scholar. He had been commissioned by the State of Israel to clarify the prerequisites of the prophesied Messiah for the modern Jew. Dr. Ben Judah created an uproar, particularly among Jews, when at the end of the live, globally televised airing of his views, he announced that Jesus the Christ was the only person in history to fulfill all the messianic prophecies, and that the vanishings were evidence that he had already come. David was impressed that the expert, while clearly not agreeing with what was going on, had an accurate handle on the issue. Having studied under Zion on the net for so long, David knew that this further outbreak of evangelism in Israel would also spawn many more false Christs and second-rate antichrists. Dr. Ben Judah had often cited Matthew chapter 24, verses 21 through 24, in urging his followers, now referred to as Judahites, to beware. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Then if anyone says to you, "Look, here is the Christ," or "There," do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. By now, David was deep into the labyrinthine inner workings of the Strong Building. While whirring through the many security pass gates using code breakers of his own design, he had a phone tucked between his cheek and shoulder. "Captain Steele," he said, "if I can do this, I'm going to get you in through one of the parking garage's inner doors. The gates will be down, but you can walk around those and get to the elevators." "We were that far," Rayford said. "The glass doors leading to the elevators are the ones we need open. We could break the glass, but we're afraid that would set off an alarm."
"Who'd hear it?"
"I know, but usually those kinds of alarms are attached to all sorts of interrelated devices. Like at the airport, you force your way through the wrong door and certain systems automatically shut down."
"Bingo," David said.
"Excuse me?"
"You're in."
"We're not even on that side of the building."
"Well, get there," David said. "I can't wait to hear what you find. Listen, good news. The designers of this building did two very nice things, as if they knew we were coming. First, the electrical panel room and the telephone room, both of which are traditionally on the top floor, or even above in some spire, are located on the first floor, one up from where you'll enter. Second, I think I have detected why the structure is so sound below where the bomb damage is. The blueprints show what's called a closure for stack effects every 15 floors or so. It happens that there is just such a closure one floor beneath where the bomb damage occurred. This closure acts as a new roof for the building. I'm not certain yet, but you may be able to land a helicopter there if you can deal with the complications of a three-sided opening above that." "Helicopter?" Rayford said.
"We're in the garage, by the way."
"I can see you."
"You can?
See the monitor up in the corner to your right?"
The three waved at David, and he almost waved back, forgetting this was not a two-way visual feed.
"Yep, I see you. The door directly in front of you should be unlocked. And yes, I said helicopter before."
"Where am I going to get one of those?"
"I don't know," David said.
"Know anybody in purchasing anywhere?"
"We also need to start thinking about a new airbase closer to here. Different, anyway.
We have no friends at Pulwalki anymore. How is Kankakee?
Might work.
How about we have Albie set up there as a small private transport company, maybe serving Laszlos, who's still considered legit by the GC? Then we can come and go as we please out of there with no questions asked, and we can chopper our way up here when we need to.
I like the way you think, Captain Steele.
I like the options you provide, David.
I'll try to keep track of you floor by floor with the various monitors, David said. But I may have to leave you abruptly, too. You know where I am.
Leah and Chloe appeared to be working well together. Though David could hear only Rayford, he could see the women checking out sight angles from various windows.
Leah wants to talk with you, David. Here she is.
You're looking at blueprints?
Online, he said. Yeah.
Am I seeing this right? Are we not visible from the street, at least where we are now?
Affirmative.
And what if we turn on lights?
That I wouldn't do.
What if we spray-painted the windows black?
Chapter 16. By 10 o'clock Saturday night in Illinois, Zion had survived two messy operations, feeding and changing Kenny. The boy was now sound asleep in his crib in the other room, and Zion had turned the sound off on the television. He merely glanced at it occasionally, tired of the endless repetition. How many times had he seen Rayford's photograph in history and the grave conclusion on the part of global community security and intelligence forces that he was the lone assassin, the lone gunman? Rayford was also constantly referred to as a committed Judahite. Zion knew, because he knew the Tribulation Force, that Rayford Steele had ceased to exist. He would neither make himself obvious to the public nor leave a trail in his own name. Zion prayed that would preserve Rayford for as long as possible. Zion pored over his Bible texts and commentaries, trying to make sense of the vivid dream. He pleaded with God for another of the same, but short of that, he wanted to understand the one he'd had. Scholars were divided on who the sun-clothed woman was, the one who wore a garland of stars and used the moon as her footstool. Clearly, she was symbolic, as no woman was that large or had a child in space. Some believed she represented womankind, as mentioned in Genesis, when God told Satan that the woman would produce a child whose heel Satan might bruise, but who would crush his head. That was a prophecy of the Christ child, and, of course, that woman turned out to be Mary. Yet further details of this symbolic woman indicated that she might symbolize Israel. The Christ came from Israel, and Satan pursued and persecuted God's chosen people even to the present day. As Zion studied the biblical texts about Lucifer and his being cast from heaven, he became convinced that when he had seen the dragon sweep a third of the stars from the skies and they fell to earth, he was witness to eternity past. The scripture often referred to angels, righteous or fallen, as stars. So he believed this was a picture of when Lucifer was first cast down due to his sin of pride. Yet Zion also knew that Satan, even up to the halfway point of the tribulation, where Zion believed history stood right then, had been granted access to the throne of God. He was the accuser of believers, yet when he pursued the woman and her child to devour them, a great battle was to be waged in heaven, and he would be cast out for good. Zion was not aware he had fallen asleep again. All he knew was that the trip from the underground safe house into the chilly night air took less getting used to this time. He didn't worry about temporal things. He could see Kenny sleeping in his crib and himself dozing on the couch as clearly as he could see the oceans and continents of the beautiful blue planet. How peaceful it looked from up here compared to what he knew was happening down there. When he arrived at the appointed place, the woman had left her footstool.
The sun garment was gone with her, of course, as was the garland of stars. Yet brightness enveloped Zion again, and he was eager to ask questions before this all faded and he awoke. Though Zion knew it was a dream, he also knew it was of God, and he rested on the promise of old men dreaming dreams. Zion turned to the brightness, marveling again at the size and majesty of the angel.
"Michael," he began, "is the woman Mary, or—"
"Michael is engaged in battle, as you will soon see. I am Gabriel, the announcer."
"Oh, forgive me, Prince Gabriel. Can you tell me who is the woman? Is it Mary, or is it Israel?"
"Yes, and yes." That was not as helpful as I had hoped. "When you ponder it, you will find it so."
"And the 12 stars on her head, do they represent the tribes of Israel?"
"Or," Gabriel prodded, "or the apostles?"
"Yes, and yes."
"Somehow I knew you were going to—" "So these things mean whatever we want or need them to mean?"
"No, they mean what they mean."
"Uh-huh. Son of Earth, did you see what the male child bore in his hand?"
"I'm sorry, I did not."
"A rod of iron with which he shall rule the nations."
"So clearly he is Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, Son of the living God."
Zion felt unworthy even to hear the description. He felt as if he were in the very presence of God.
"Prince Gabriel, to where has the woman fled?"
"Into the wilderness, where God has prepared a place for her, where she will be safe for 3.5 years.
"Does this mean God has prepared a place in the wilderness for his chosen people, where they too will be safe during the great tribulation?"
"You have said it."
"And what of the dragon?"
"He is enraged."
"And Michael?"
Gabriel gestured behind Zion. "Behold!" Zion turned to see a great battle raging. Michael and his angels wielded great double-edged swords against fiery darts from the dragon and his evil angels. The ugly hordes advanced again and again against Michael's mighty forces, but they could not prevail. As his comrades retreated behind him, the dragon fled to the throne. But it was as if a colossal invisible door had been slammed in his face. He fell back and tried to advance again to the place he had enjoyed before the throne. But from the throne came an insistent,
"No, there is no longer a place here for you. Be gone!"
The dragon turned, his anger nearly consuming him. With his 7 heads grimacing and gnashing their teeth, he gathered his own around him, and they all tumbled toward the earth. And Gabriel announced in a loud voice,
"So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him."
And now, louder still, with great joy, "Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time."
"What happens now?"
Zion said. Gabriel looked at him and folded his arms.
The dragon will persecute the woman who gave birth to the child, but God will protect her. In his wrath, the dragon will make war with the rest of her offspring, those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus the Christ. Michael stood next to Gabriel now, his great sword sheathed, his warriors dispersed. Zion could not speak. He opened his mouth to form words of gratitude, but he was mute, and he awoke. It was still 10 o'clock. By 9 in the morning Carpathia time, New Babylon was a sea of people. Opportunists had set up shop on every road that led to the palace courtyard. Sellers of chairs, sunblock, umbrellas, bottled water, food, and souvenirs preyed on the pilgrims. Some merchants were run off by GC peacekeepers, only to set up again a quarter mile away. It was clear the forecasted 100 degrees would be surpassed before noon. A canopy was erected behind the bier to protect both it and the armed guards from the relentless sun. Still, mourners and officials dropped right and left and were ferried to medical tents, where they were hydrated and fanned and sometimes doused with water. David returned to his perch above one of the med tents, though it had been moved more than 200 yards from the courtyard to make room for the crowds. Barriers, ropes, and makeshift fences forced people to snake back and forth in an agonizingly slow path to the bier. Street entertainers, jugglers, clowns, strippers, and vendors tried to keep people occupied. Here and there scuffles broke out, quickly quelled by the peacekeepers. Laborers continued to swarm, finalizing the reconstruction that would allow hundreds of thousands more in the courtyard. The huge screens were in place and operating, as were countless monitors surrounding the palace. When the ceremony was about to begin at noon, the line would be stopped and millions would fan out from the speaker's platform next to the coffin to more than a mile away. From his spot, David heard bands practicing, choirs rehearsing, dance troupes going through their paces. With binoculars, he saw Annie manning her station nearly a half mile away. His phone chirped. It was a peacekeeper at the airport. "Director Hasid, I have a family here from China looking for their daughter, a GC employee named Ming Toy." "Yes?" "They say she told them to contact you or Cargo Chief Christopher if they could not find their daughter. She's come from Buffer in Brussels." "Do they know where she's positioned here? It's all numbered, you know." The guard covered the phone and asked them. "No," he said. "They said they thought their daughter was trying to get assigned near Ms. Christopher." "Ms. Christopher is stationed at Marker 53. "Thank you, sir." David kept his field glasses trained on Annie and saw when the red-uniformed Asian approached and they embraced. They engaged in what appeared an animated conversation, and Annie grabbed her phone. David's erupted again. "Hi, babe," he said. "Ming's parents and brother are on their way from the airport and will look for her at your station. Did she get assigned?"
"David," Annie whispered fiercely. "North American GC has identified the safe house."
"What?"
"Ming overheard it. She couldn't let me know before because they gathered everyone's phones for security."
"Call Zion. I'll call Steele."
Rayford believed the new safe house might be the greatest gift God had bestowed on the Trib Force since the arrival of Zion ben Judah. Several floors had been left virtually unblemished, and all the systems worked. There were more bathrooms than the occupants could ever use, and every service imaginable. It wasn't a home, of course, so beds would have to be brought in or fashioned. But the place could hold hundreds, maybe more. He didn't know how reasonable it was to think a whole lot of people could hide out there undetected, but he dreamed of inviting every dispossessed believer he knew. Leah's friend from Brussels, maybe her brother from China, Albi, maybe the Miklos's one day, all the insiders from New Babylon. A guy could dream. He and Leah and Chloe were headed back toward Mount Prospect just after midnight, Central Standard Time, when David called with the news. "Annie's calling Zion," David said. "He's got to get out of there.
There are certain things we have to have, Rayford said, and Zion doesn't have wheels.
Captain, he's got to get out of there now.
We have to go get him, David. Any way you can tell where we might run into GC?
Not in time to help you.
You might have to take some risks.
We'll also try to get Zion on the phone. Who knows where the GC is or when they might strike? Our underground is a pretty good cover.
Zion thanked Annie and rushed to shut off the power, trying to keep from hyperventilating. He felt his way in the dark and filled two pillowcases with necessities. The TV would stay. He gathered up essential medicines, a few reference works, and all the laptops, baby stuff, a handful of clothes, whatever he could fit into the bulging slipcases. He left enough room at the tops to tie them together and left them at the bottom of the stairs. There was only one way out of the shelter, and that was the way he had come in. Even if he were to throw a blanket over Kenny and lug him and the stuff out into the garage, that would be the second place the GC would look. His best hope, he knew, was to hear the GC come in upstairs, pray that they would be stopped by the spoiled food in the phony freezer, find no one, and move on. Then he would be ready to flee as soon as the others arrived. Chloe called, nearly hysterical.
"Zion," she said, "if the GC gets to the cellar, you have to promise me..."
"I'll protect the baby with my life."
"You have to promise me, Zion, please. Under my mattress is a syringe with a potassium chloride solution. It'll work quick, but you have to inject it directly into his buttocks. You can do it right through the diaper. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be decisive and sure."
"Chloe, get hold of yourself. I'm not going to harm Kenny."
"Zion," she cried, "please, don't ever let them have my baby."
"I won't, but I'll not..."
"Please."
"No. Now let me do my work. I have to watch and listen. For now, Kenny is down and out. God is with us."
"Zion."
"Goodbye, Chloe."
Zion went to the edge of the underground with the thinnest barrier to the outside and stood listening for engines or footsteps, doors, windows. So far, nothing. He hated being trapped. He was tempted to lug Kenny and the stuff to the garage, then make a break for it if the GC broke into the house. It was foolishness, he knew. He'd get nowhere on foot. His more-than-lifelike dream had put him on a first-name basis with the archangels of God, yet there he stood, cowering in a corner. He guessed Rayford was, at best, nearly an hour away. And if he happened to arrive when the GC was already there, Rayford would have to disappear. Zion prayed the GC had decided to take its time, to come the next day or the next week. Until he sat in a cramped jet for a transatlantic flight, Buck didn't realize how extensive were his injuries. He felt 20 years older, wincing and sometimes yelping when he moved. A couple of hours after Albie had taken off in a refurbished Jordanian fighter, the type with which Abdullah was most familiar, Buck had gotten word from Leah about the pastor who wanted to speak with him. He told her to give the man his number, but to be sure he called from a public phone. The resulting conversation was one bright spot in a harrowing weekend. "Your brother was the instigator," the pastor told him. "He confronted your father about his stubborn insistence that he was a believer and always had been. Your brother visited our house church by himself the first 2 or 3 times, and to hear your father tell it, he finally came just to avoid being alone. Mr. Williams, it took a long time for your father to get the picture."
"It would."
"Your brother less so. It was as if he were ready. But he knew better than to push your father. One of the biggest obstacles was that he knew one day he would have to admit that you were right and he was wrong." Buck fought tears.
"That's Pop, all right. But why?
Didn't your brother call?"
"2 reasons. He wanted your dad to be the one to share the news. He was scared to death they were going to somehow give you away. He knew well your position and how dangerous it was, or I should say is. Only calling from a bugged phone would have caused a problem. But he didn't know that. I just want you to know, sir, that your dad and your brother became true believers, and I'm sure they're with God right now. They were so proud of you. And you can tell Dr. Benjuda that he has at least one church out here that could lose its pastor and never skip a beat. We all love him. Buck assured him he would tell Zion. They were an hour from Pawaukee when Buck got the call from Chloe about the safe house. While Chaim lay across the back seat, humming in agony over his various ailments, Albi seemed to grow more and more agitated as he realized what was going on. "How was the safe house compromised?" he said. "Did Miss Durham finally give you up?" "We don't know, Albi. All we know for sure is that Dr. Benjuda and our baby are there without transportation, and we have no idea how far away the GC is or whether Rayford can get there in time."
"And you have a new safe house, somewhere to go if you can get them out of there?"
"Yes. Grab my bag from behind my seat." Buck pulled it up, deciding it weighed more than Albi. "What have you got in this thing?" Albi was all business. "Open, please." The top layer consisted of Albi's underwear. "Dig, please. Find sidearm and holster." Buck dug past what looked like a GC uniform. "Is this what I think it is?" Albi nodded with a pleased look. "See cap. Check rank." Buck whistled. "Deputy Commander? Where did you get this?" "No questions, no obligations." "Come on, did you used to work for the GC?
"Better not to know."
"But did you?"
"No, but no more questions."
"Just where did you..."
"I have my sources. Sources are my life. Call Rayford. Tell him to meet us at Pawaukee."
"He shouldn't get to the safe house?"
"We need a vehicle. We need it as bad as Rayford needs it."
"How so?"
"Watch and learn. At Pawaukee, where can I change into the uniform?"
"You're going to..."
"You don't ask."